and so soon. The knights began to hack at the door with their axes, but they made little headway. It had been made to withstand attack. William felt control slipping away from him. Fighting back the beginnings of a panic, he ran out of the porch and looked around for another door. Reginald went with him. There was nothing on this side of the building. They ran around the west end of the palace, past the detached kitchen, into the orchard on the south side. William grunted with satisfaction. There on the south wall of the palace was a staircase leading to the upper floor. It looked like a private entrance to the Archbishop's chambers. The feeling of panic went away. William and Reginald ran to the foot of the staircase. It was damaged halfway up, and there were a few workmen's tools and a ladder nearby, as if the stairs were being repaired. Reginald leaned the ladder against the side of the staircase and climbed up, bypassing the broken steps. He reached the top. There was a door leading to an oriel, a little enclosed balcony. William watched him try the door. It was locked. Beside it was a shuttered window. Reginald smashed the shutter with one blow of his axe. He reached inside, fumbled, then opened the door and went in. William started to climb the ladder. Philip was scared from the moment he saw William Hamley, but the priests and monks in Thomas's entourage were at first complacent. Then, when they heard the hammering on the hall door, they became frightened, and several of them proposed taking refuge in the cathedral. Thomas was scornful. "Take refuge," he said. "From what? Those knights? An archbishop can't run from a few hotheads." Philip thought he was right up to a point. The title of archbishop was meaningless if you could be frightened by knights. The man of God, secured in the knowledge that his sins are forgiven, regards death as a happy transfer to a better place, and has no fear of swords. However, even an archbishop ought not to be so careless of his safety as to invite attack. Furthermore, Philip had first-hand knowledge of the viciousness and brutality of William Hamley. So when they heard the smashing of the oriel shutter, Philip decided to take a lead. He could see, through the windows, that the palace was surrounded by knights. The sight of them scared him more. This was clearly a carefully planned attack, and the perpetrators were prepared to commit violence. He hastily closed the bedroom door and pulled the bar across. The others watched him, content to let someone decisive take charge. Archbishop Thomas continued to look scornful, but he did not try to stop Philip. Philip stood by the door and listened. He heard a man come through the oriel and enter the audience chamber. He wondered how strong the bedroom door was. However, the man did not attack the door, but crossed the audience chamber and started down the stairs. Philip guessed he was going to open the hall door from the inside and let the rest of the knights in that way. That gave Thomas a few moments' reprieve. There was another door in the opposite corner of the bedroom, partly concealed by the bed. Philip pointed at it and said urgently, "Where does that lead?" "To the cloisters," someone said, "but it's locked shut." Philip crossed the room and tried the door. It was locked. "Have you got a key?" he said to Thomas, adding as an afterthought, "My Lord Archbishop." Thomas shook his head. "That passage has never been used in my memory," he said with infuriating calm. The door did not look very stout, but Philip was 63 years old, and brute force had never been his métier. He stood back and gave the door a kick. It hurt his foot. The door rattled flimsily. Philip gritted his teeth and kicked it harder. It flew open. Philip looked at Thomas. Thomas still seemed reluctant to flee. Perhaps it had not dawned on him, as it had on Philip, that the number of knights and the well-organized nature of their operation indicated a deadly, serious intention to do him harm. But Philip knew instinctively that it would be fruitless to try to scare Thomas into fleeing. Instead, he said, "It's time for vespers. We ought not to let a few hotheads disrupt the routine of worship." Thomas smiled, seeing that his own argument had been used against him. "Very well," he said, and he got to his feet. Philip led the way, feeling relief that he had got Thomas moving, and fear that the archbishop still might not move fast enough. The passage led down a long flight of steps. There was no light except what came through the archbishop's bedroom. At the end of the passage was another door. Philip gave it the same treatment as he had given the first door, but this one was stronger and it did not open. He began to hammer on it, shouting, Help! Open the door! Hurry! Hurry! He heard the note of panic in his own voice and made an effort to stay calm, but his heart was racing, and he knew that William's knights must be close behind. The others caught up with him. He continued to bang the door and shout. He heard Thomas say, "Dignity, Philip, please," but he took no notice. He wanted to preserve the Archbishop's dignity. His own was of no account. Before Thomas could protest again, there was the sound of a bar being drawn and a key turning in the lock, and the door was opened. Philip grunted with relief. Two startled cellarers stood there. One said, "I didn't know this door led anywhere." Philip pushed past them impatiently. He found himself in the cellarers' stores. He negotiated the barrels and sacks to reach another door, and passed through that into the open air. It was getting dark. He was in the south walk of the cloisters. At the far end of the walk he saw, to his immense relief, the door that led into the north transept of Canterbury Cathedral. They were almost safe. He had to get Thomas into the cathedral before William and his knights could catch up. The rest of the party emerged from the stores. Philip said, "Into the church, quickly." Thomas said, "No, Philip, not quickly. We will enter my cathedral with dignity." Philip wanted to scream, but he said, "Of course, my lord." He could hear the ominous sound of heavy feet in the disused passage. The knights had broken into the bedroom and had found the bolt hole. He knew the Archbishop's best protection was his dignity, but there was no harm in getting out of the way of trouble. "Where is the Archbishop's cross?" Thomas said. "I can't enter the church without my cross." Philip groaned in despair. Then one of the priests said, "I brought the cross. Here it is." Thomas said, "Carry it before me in the usual way, please." The priest held it up and walked with restrained haste toward the church door. Thomas followed him. The Archbishop's entourage preceded him into the cathedral, as etiquette demanded. Philip went last and held the door for him. Just as Thomas entered, two knights burst out of the cellarer's stores and sprinted down the south walk. Philip closed the transept door. There was a bar located in a hole in the wall beside the doorpost. Philip grabbed the bar and pulled it across the door. He turned around, sagging with relief, and leaned back against the door. Thomas was crossing the narrow transept toward the steps that led up to the north aisle of the chancel, but when he heard the bar slam into place, he stopped suddenly and turned around. "No, Philip," he said. Philip's heart sank. "My lord, Archbishop, this is a church, not a castle. Unbar the door." The door shook violently as the knights tried to open it. Philip said, "I'm afraid they want to kill you." "Then they will probably succeed, whether you bar the door or not. Do you know how many other doors there are to this church? Open it." There was a series of loud bangs, as if the knights were attacking the door with axes. "You could hide," Philip said desperately. "There are dozens of places. The entrance to the crypt is just there. It's getting dark." "Hide, Philip? In my own church? Would you?" Philip stared at Thomas for a long moment. At last he said, "No, I wouldn't. Open the door." With a heavy heart, Philip slid back the bar. The knights burst in. There were five of them. Their faces were hidden behind helmets. They carried swords and axes. They looked like emissaries from hell. Philip knew he should not be afraid, but the sharp edges of their weapons made him shiver with fear. One of them shouted, "Where is Thomas Becket, the traitor to the king and to the kingdom?" The other shouted, "Where is the traitor? Where is the Archbishop?" It was quite dark now, and the big church was only dimly lit by candles. All the monks were in black, and the knights' vision was somewhat limited by their faceplates. Philip had a sudden surge of hope. Perhaps they would miss Thomas in the darkness. But Thomas immediately dashed that hope by walking down the steps toward the knight, saying, "Here I am, no traitor to the king, but a priest of God. What do you want?" As the Archbishop stood confronting the five men with their drawn swords, Philip suddenly knew with certainty that Thomas was going to die here today. The people in the Archbishop's entourage must have had the same feeling, for suddenly most of them fled. Some disappeared into the gloom of the chancel, a few scattered into the nave among the townspeople waiting for the service, and one opened a small door and ran up a spiral staircase. Philip was disgusted. "You should pray, not run!" he shouted after them. It occurred to Philip that he too might be killed if he did not run. But he could not tear himself away from the side of the archbishop. One of the knights said to Thomas, "Renounce your treachery." Philip recognized the voice of Reginald Fitzurse, who had done the talking earlier. "I have nothing to renounce," Thomas replied. "I have committed no treachery." He was deadly calm, but his face was white, and Philip realized that Thomas, like everyone else, had realized that he was going to die. Reginald shouted at Thomas, "Run away! You're a dead man!" Thomas stood still. "They want him to run," Philip thought. "They can't bring themselves to kill him in cold blood." Perhaps Thomas had understood that, too, for he stood unflinching in front of them, defying them to touch him. For a long moment they were all frozen in a murderous tableau, the knight unwilling to make the first move, the priest too proud to run. It was Thomas who fatally broke the spell. He said, "I am ready to die, but you are not to touch any of my men, priests or monks or laymen." Reginald moved first. He waved his sword at Thomas, pushing its point closer and closer to his face, as if daring himself to let the blade touch the priest. Thomas stood like stone, his eyes focused on the knight, not the sword. Suddenly, with a quick twist of the wrist, Reginald knocked Thomas's cap off. Philip was suddenly filled with hope again. "They can't bring themselves to do it," he thought. "They're afraid to touch him." But he was wrong. The knight's resolution seemed to be strengthened by the silly gesture of knocking off the archbishop's cap, as if perhaps they had half expected to be struck down by the hand of God, and the fact that they had got away with it gave them courage to do worse. Reginald said, "Carry him out of here." The other knights sheathed their swords and approached the archbishop. One of them grasped Thomas about the waist and tried to lift him. Philip despaired. They had touched him at last. They were, after all, willing to lay hands on a man of God. Philip had a stomach-lurching sense of the depths of their evil, like looking over the edge of a bottomless pit. They must know in their hearts that they would go to hell for this. Yet still they did it. Thomas lost his balance, flailed his arms, and began to struggle. The other knights joined in trying to lift him up and carry him. The only people left from Thomas's entourage were Philip and a priest called Edward Grimm. They both rushed forward to help Thomas. Edward grabbed Thomas's mantle and clung on tight. One of the knights turned and lashed out at Philip with a mailed fist. The blow struck the side of Philip's head and he went down, dazed. When he recovered, the knights had released Thomas, who was standing with his head bowed and his hands together in an attitude of prayer. One of the knights raised his sword. Philip, still on the floor, gave a long, helpless yell of protest. "No!" Edward Grimm held out his arm to ward off the blow. Thomas said, "I commend myself to God." The sword fell. It struck both Thomas and Edward. Philip heard himself scream. The sword cut into the archbishop's skull and sliced the priest's arm. As blood spurted from Edward's arm, Thomas fell to his knees. Philip stared aghast at the appalling wound to Thomas's head. The archbishop fell slowly forward onto his hands, supported himself only for an instant, then crashed onto his face on the stone floor. Another knight lifted his sword and struck. Philip gave an involuntary howl of grief. The second blow landed in the same place as the first and sliced off the top of Thomas's skull. It was such a forceful swing that the sword struck the pavement and snapped in two. The knight dropped the stump. A third knight committed an act which would burn in Philip's memory for the rest of his life. He stuck the point of his sword into the opened head of the archbishop and spilled the brains out onto the floor. Philip's legs felt weak and he sank to his knees, overcome with horror. The knight said, "He won't get up again. Let's be off." They all turned and ran. Philip watched them go down the nave, laying about them with their swords to scatter the townspeople. When the killers had gone, there was a moment of frozen silence. The corpse of the archbishop lay face down on the floor, and the severed skull with its hair lay beside the head like the lid of a pot. Philip buried his face in his hands. This was the end of all hope. The savages have won, he kept thinking. The savages have won. He had a giddy, weightless sensation, as if he were sinking slowly in a deep lake, drowning in despair. There was nothing to hold on to anymore. Everything that had seemed fixed was suddenly unstable. He had spent his life fighting the arbitrary power of wicked men, and now, in the ultimate contest, he had been defeated. He remembered when William Hamley had come to set fire to Kingsbridge the second time, and the townspeople had built a wall in a day. What a victory that had been! The peaceful strength of hundreds of ordinary people had defeated the naked cruelty of Earl William. He recalled the time when Waller and Bigod had tried to have the cathedral built at Shiring, so that he could control it for his own ends. Philip had mobilized the people of the whole county. Hundreds of them, more than 1,000, had flocked to Kingsbridge on that marvellous Whitsun Day 33 years ago, and the sheer force of their zeal had defeated Walleran. But there was no hope now. All the ordinary folk in Canterbury, even the entire population of Christendom, would not be enough to bring Thomas back to life. Kneeling on the flagstones in the north transept of Canterbury Cathedral, he saw again the men who had burst into his home and slaughtered his mother and father before his eyes 56 years ago. The emotion that came to him now from that 6-year-old child was not fear, not even grief. It was rage. Powerless to stop those huge, red-faced, bloodthirsty men, he had conceived a blazing ambition to shackle all such swordsmen, to blunt their swords and hobble their war-horses, and force them to submit to another authority, one higher than the monarchy of violence. And moments later, as his parents lay dead on the floor, Abbot Peter had come in to show him the way. Unarmed and defenseless, the abbot had instantly stopped the bloodshed. With nothing but the authority of his church and the force of his goodness, that scene had inspired Philip all his life. Until this moment he had believed that he and people like him were winning. They had achieved some notable victories in the past half-century, but now, at the end of his life, his enemies had proved that nothing had changed. His triumphs had been temporary, his progress illusory. He had won some battles, but the cause was ultimately hopeless. Men just like the ones who killed his mother and father had now murdered an archbishop in a cathedral, as if to prove, beyond all possibility of doubt, that there was no authority that could prevail against the tyranny of a man with a sword. He had never thought they would dare to kill Archbishop Thomas, especially in a church. But he had never thought anyone could kill his father. And the same bloodthirsty men with swords and helmets had shown him the grisly truth in both cases. And now, at the age of 62, as he looked at the grisly corpse of Thomas Becket, he was possessed by the childish, unreasoning, all-encompassing fury of a 6-year-old boy whose father is dead. He stood up. The atmosphere in the church was thick with emotion as the people gathered around the corpse of the archbishop. Priests, monks, and townspeople came slowly nearer, stunned and full of dread. Philip sensed that behind their shocked expressions there was a rage like his own. One or two of them were muttering prayers or just moaning half audibly. A woman bent down swiftly and touched the dead body as if for luck. Several other people followed suit. Then Philip saw the first woman furtively collecting some of the blood in a tiny flask as if Thomas were a martyr. The clergy began to come to their senses. The Archbishop's Chamberlain, Osbert, with tears streaming down his face, took out a knife and cut a strip from his own shirt, then bent down by the body and clumsily, gruesomely tied Thomas's skull back onto his head, in a pathetic attempt to restore a modicum of dignity to the horribly violated person of the Archbishop. As he did so, a low collective groan went up from the crowd all around. Some monks brought a stretcher. They lifted Thomas onto it gently. Many hands reached out to help them. Philip saw that the Archbishop's handsome face was peaceful, the only sign of violence being a thin line of blood running from the right temple across the nose to the left cheek. As they lifted the stretcher, Philip picked up the broken stump of the sword that had killed Thomas. He kept thinking of the woman who had collected the Archbishop's blood in a bottle as if he were a saint. There was a massive significance to that small act of hers. but Philip was not yet sure exactly what it was. The people followed the stretcher, drawn by an invisible force. Philip went with the crowd, feeling the weird compulsion that gripped them all. The monks carried the body through the chancel and lowered it gently to the ground in front of the high altar. The crowd, many of them praying aloud, watched as a priest brought a clean cloth and bandaged the head neatly, then covered most of the bandage with a new cap. A monk cut through the black archbishop's mantle, which was soiled with blood, and removed it. The man seemed unsure what to do with the bloody garment, and turned as if to throw it to one side. A citizen stepped forward quickly and took it from him as if it were a precious object. The thought that had been hovering uncertainly in the back of Philip's mind now came to the foreground in an inspirational flash. The citizens were treating Thomas like a martyr, eagerly collecting his blood and his clothes as if they had the supernatural powers of saints' relics. Philip had been regarding the murder as a political defeat for the church, but the people here did not see it that way. They saw a martyrdom, and the death of a martyr, while it might look like a defeat, never failed to provide inspiration and strength to the church in the end. Philip thought again of the hundreds of people who had flocked to Kingsbridge to build the cathedral, and of the men, women, and children who had worked together half the night to put up the town wall. If such people could be mobilized now, he thought with a mounting sense of excitement, they might raise a cry of outrage so loud it would be heard all over the world. Looking at the men and women gathered around the body, their faces suffused with grief and horror, Philip realized that they only wanted a leader. Was it possible? There was something familiar about this situation, he realized. A mutilated corpse, a crowd of onlookers, and some soldiers in the distance. Where had he seen this before? What should happen next, he felt, was that a small group of followers of the dead man would range themselves against all the power and authority of a mighty empire. Of course. That was how Christianity started. And when he understood that, he knew what he had to do next. He moved in front of the altar and turned to face the crowd. He still had the broken sword in his hand. Everyone stared at him. He suffered a moment of self-doubt. Can I do it? He thought. Can I start a movement here and now that will shake the throne of England? He looked at their faces. As well as grief and rage, he saw, in one or two expressions, a hint of hope. He lifted the sword on high. This sword killed a saint, he began. There was a murmur of agreement. Encouraged, Philip said, Here tonight we have witnessed a martyrdom. The priests and monks looked surprised. Like Philip, they had not immediately seen the real significance of the murder they had witnessed, but the townspeople had, and they voiced their approval. Each one of us must go from this place and tell what he has seen. Several people nodded vigorously. They were listening, but Philip wanted more. He wanted to inspire them. Preaching had never been his forte. He was not one of those men who could hold a crowd rapt, make them laugh and cry, and persuade them to follow him anywhere. He did not know how to put a tremor in his voice and make the light of glory shine from his eyes. He was a practical, earthbound man, and right now he needed to speak like an angel. Soon, every man, woman, and child in Canterbury will know that the King's men murdered Archbishop Thomas in the cathedral. But that's just the start. The news will spread all over England and then all over Christendom. He was losing them, he could tell. There was dissatisfaction and disappointment on some of the faces. A man called out, But what shall we do? Philip realized they needed to take some kind of concrete action immediately. It was not possible to call for a crusade and then send people to bed. A crusade, he thought. That was an idea. He said, Tomorrow, I will take this sword to Rochester, the day after tomorrow, London. Will you come with me? Most of them looked blank, but someone at the back called out, Yes! Then one or two others voiced their agreement. Philip raised his voice a little. We'll tell our story in every town and village in England. We'll show people the sword that killed Saint Thomas. We'll let them see the bloodstains on his priestly garments. He warmed to his theme, and let his anger show a little. "We'll raise an outcry that will spread throughout Christendom. Yes, even as far as Rome. We'll turn the whole of the civilized world against the savages who perpetrated this horrible, blasphemous crime." This time most of them called out their assent. They had been waiting for some way of expressing their emotions, and now he was giving it to them. "This crime," he said slowly, his voice rising to a shout, "will never, never be forgotten." They roared their approval. Suddenly, he knew where to go from here. "Let us begin our crusade now," he said. "Yes, we'll carry this sword along every street in Canterbury. Yes! And we'll tell every citizen within the walls what we have witnessed here tonight. Yes! Bring candles and follow me." Holding the sword high, he marched straight down the middle of the cathedral. They followed him. Feeling exultant, he went through the chancel, over the crossing, and down the nave. Some of the monks and priests walked beside him. He did not need to look back. He could hear the footsteps of 100 people marching behind him. He went out of the main door. There he had a moment of anxiety. Across the dark orchard, he could see men-at-arms ransacking the archbishop's palace. If his followers confronted them, the crusade might turn into a brawl when it had hardly got started. Suddenly afraid, he turned sharply away and led the crowd through the nearest gate into the street. One of the monks started a hymn. There were lamps and firelight behind the shutters of the houses, but as the procession passed by, people opened their doors to see what was going on. Some of them questioned the marchers. Some joined in. Philip turned a corner and saw William Hamley. William was standing outside a stable and looked as if he had just taken off his chainmail prior to mounting a horse and leaving the city. He had a handful of men with him. They were all looking up expectantly, presumably having heard the singing and wondered what was going on. As the candle-lit procession approached, William at first looked mystified. Then he saw the broken sword in Philip's hand, and comprehension dawned. He stared in awe-struck silence for a moment more, then he spoke. "Stop this!" he shouted. "I command you to disperse!" Nobody took any notice. The men with William looked anxious. Even with their swords, they were vulnerable to a mob of more than 100 fervent mourners. William addressed Philip directly. "In the name of the king, I order you to stop this." Philip swept past him, borne forward by the press of the crowd. "Too late, William," he cried over his shoulder. "Too late." 3. The small boys came early to the hanging. They were already there in the market square at Shiring, throwing stones at cats and abusing beggars and fighting one another, when Aliena arrived, alone and on foot, wearing a cheap cloak with a hood to hide her identity. She stood at a distance, looking at the scaffold. She had not intended to come. She had witnessed too many hangings during the years when she had played the role of Earl. Now that she no longer had that responsibility, she had thought she would be happy if she never saw another man hanged for the rest of her life. But this one was different. She was no longer acting as Earl because her brother Richard had been killed in Syria, not in battle, ironically, but in an earthquake. The news had taken 6 months to reach her. She had not seen him for 15 years, and now she would never see him again. Up the hill, the castle gates opened, and the prisoner came out with his escort, followed by the new Earl of Shiring, Aliena's son, Tommy. Richard had never had children, so his heir was his nephew. The king, stunned and enfeebled by the Becket scandal, had taken the line of least resistance and rapidly confirmed Tommy as Earl. Aliena had handed over to the younger generation readily. She had achieved what she wanted to do with the earldom. It was once again a rich, thriving county, a land of fat sheep and green fields and sturdy mills. Some of the larger and more progressive landowners had followed her lead in switching to horse ploughing, feeding the horses on oats grown under the three-field system of crop rotation. In consequence, the land could feed even more people than it had under her father's enlightened rule. Tommy would be a good earl. It was what he was born to do. Jack had refused to see it for a long time, wanting his son to be a builder, but eventually he had been forced to admit the truth. Tommy had never been able to cut a stone in a straight line, but he was a natural leader, and at 28 years of age he was decisive, determined, intelligent, and fair-minded. He was usually called Thomas now. When he took over, people expected Aliena to stay at the castle, nag her daughter-in-law, and play with her grandchildren. She had laughed at them. She liked Tommy's wife, a pretty girl, one of the younger daughters of the Earl of Bedford, and she adored her three grandchildren. But at the age of 52 she was not ready to retire. She and Jack had taken a big stone house near the Kingsbridge Priory, in what had once been the poor quarter, although it was no longer, and she had gone back into the wool business, buying and selling, negotiating with all her old energy and making money hand over fist. The hanging party came into the square, and Aliena emerged from her reverie. She looked closely at the prisoner stumbling along at the end of a rope, his hands tied behind his back. It was William Hamley. Someone in the front spat at him. The crowd in the square was large, for a lot of people were happy to see the last of William, and even for those who had no grudge against him, it was quite something to see a former sheriff hanged. But William had been involved in the most notorious murder anybody could remember. Aliena had never known or imagined anything like the reaction to the killing of Archbishop Thomas. The news had spread like wildfire through the whole of Christendom, from Dublin to Jerusalem and from Toledo to Oslo. The Pope had gone into mourning. The continental half of King Henry's empire had been placed under interdict, which meant the churches were closed and there were no services except baptism. In England, people had started making a pilgrimage to Canterbury, just as if it were a shrine like Santiago de Compostela. And there had been miracles. Water, tinctured with the martyr's blood, and shreds of the mantle he had been wearing when he was killed, cured sick people, not just in Canterbury, but all over England. William's men had tried to steal the corpse from the cathedral, but the monks had been forewarned and had hidden it, and now it was secure within a stone vault, and pilgrims had to put their heads through a hole in the wall to kiss the marble coffin. It was William's last crime. He had come scurrying back to Shiring, but Tommy had arrested him and accused him of sacrilege, and he had been found guilty by Bishop Philip's court. Normally no one would dare to sentence a sheriff, for he was an officer of the crown. But in this case the reverse was true. No one, not even the king, would dare to defend one of Becket's killers. William was going to make a bad end. His eyes were wild and staring, his mouth was open and drooling, he was moaning incoherently, and there was a stain on the front of his tunic where he had wet himself. Aliena watched her old enemy stagger blindly toward the gallows. She remembered the young, arrogant, heartless lad who had raped her 35 years ago. It was hard to believe he had become the moaning, terrified subhuman she saw now. Even the fat, gouty, disappointed old knight he had been in later life was nothing like this. He began to struggle and scream as he got close to the scaffold. The men-at-arms pulled him along like a pig going to the slaughterhouse. Aliena found no pity in her heart. All she could feel was relief. William would never terrorize anyone again. He kicked and screamed as he was lifted up onto the ox cart. He looked like an animal, red-faced, wild and filthy, but he sounded like a child as he gibbered and moaned and cried. It took four men to hold him, while a fifth put the noose around his neck. He struggled so much that the knot tightened before he dropped, and he began to strangle by his own efforts. The men-at-arms stepped back. William writhed, choking, his fat face turning purple. Aliena stared, aghast. Even at the height of her rage and hatred she had not wished a death like this on him. There was no noise, now that he was choking, and the crowd stood still. Even the small boys were silenced by the horrible sight. Someone struck the ox's flank with a switch, and the beast moved forward. At last William fell, but the fall did not break his neck, and he dangled at the end of the rope, slowly suffocating. His eyes remained open. Aliena felt he was looking at her. The grimace on his face as he hung there, writhing in agony, was familiar to Aliena, and she realized that he looked like that when he was raping her just before he reached his climax. The memory stabbed her like a knife, but she would not let herself look away. It took a long time, but the crowd remained quiet throughout. His face turned darker and darker. His agonized writhing became mere twitching. At last his eyes rolled up into his head, his eyelids closed, he became still, and then, gruesomely, his tongue stuck out black and swollen between his teeth. He was dead. Aliena felt drained. William had changed her life. At one time she would have said he had ruined her life. And now he was dead, powerless to hurt her or anyone else ever again. The crowd began to move away. The small boys mimicked the death throes to one another, rolling up their eyes and poking out their tongues. A man-at-arms climbed up on the scaffold and cut William down. Aliena caught her son's eye. He looked surprised to see her. He came over immediately and bent down to kiss her. "My son," she thought, "my big son, Jack's son." She remembered how terrified she had been that she might have William's child. Well, some things had turned out right. "I thought you didn't want to come here today," Tommy said.
"I had to," she said. "I had to see him dead."
He looked startled. He did not understand, not really. She was glad. She hoped he would never have to understand such things.
He put his arm around her, and they walked out of the square together.
Aliena did not look back. On a hot day in a high summer, Jack ate dinner with Aliena and Sally in the cool of the north transept, up in the gallery, sitting on the scratched plaster of his tracing floor. The sound of the monks chanting the service of Sext in the chancel was a low murmur like the rushing of a distant waterfall. They had cold lamb chops with fresh wheat bread and a stone jug of golden beer. Jack had spent the morning sketching the layout of the new chancel, which he would begin building next year. Sally was looking at his drawing while she tore into a chop with her pretty white teeth. In a moment she would say something critical about it, he knew. He glanced at Aliena. She, too, had read Sally's face and knew what was coming. They exchanged a knowing parental look and smiled.
"Why do you want the east end to be rounded?" Sally said.
"I based it on the design of Saint-Denis," Jack said.
"But is there any advantage?"
"Yes. You can keep the pilgrims moving.
So you just have this row of little windows."
Jack had thought windows would come up soon, for Sally was a glazier.
"Little windows," he said, pretending to be indignant. "Those windows are huge. When I first put windows that size into this church, the people thought the whole building would fall down for lack of structural support. If the chancel was square-ended, you would have an enormous flat wall." Sally persisted. "You could put in really big windows."
She had a point, Jack thought. With the round-ended layout, the entire chancel had to have the same continuous elevation, divided into the traditional three layers of arcade, gallery, and clerestory, all the way around. A square end offered a chance to change the design. "There might be another way to keep the pilgrims moving," he said thoughtfully.
"And the rising sun would shine through the big windows," Sally said.
Jack could imagine it. There could be a row of tall lancets like spears in a rack. Sally said, "Or one big round window like a rose." That was a stunning idea. To someone standing in the nave, looking down the length of the church toward the east, the round window would seem like a huge sun exploding into innumerable shards of gorgeous color. Jack could just see it. "I wonder what theme the monks would want."
"The law and the prophets," Sally said.
He raised his eyebrows at her. "You sly vixen, you've already discussed this idea with Prior Jonathan, haven't you?" She looked guilty, but she was saved from answering by the arrival of Peter Chisel, a young stone carver. He was a shy, awkward man with fair hair that fell over his eyes, but his carvings were beautiful, and Jack was glad to have him.
"What can I do for you, Peter?" he said.
"Actually, I was looking for Sally," Peter said.
"Well, you found her."
Sally was getting to her feet,
brushing breadcrumbs off the front of her tunic. "I'll see you later," she said, and then she and Peter went through the low doorway and down the spiral staircase. Jack and Aliena looked at one another. "Was she blushing?" Jack said. "I hope so," said Aliena. "My goodness, it's about time she fell for someone. She's 26 years old." Well, well, I'd given up hope. I thought she was planning to be an old maid. Aliena shook her head. "Not Sally. She's as lusty as anyone. She's just choosy." "Is she?" Jack said. "The girls of the county aren't queuing up to marry Peter Chisel." "The girls of the county fall for big, handsome men like Tommy, who can cut a dash on horseback and have their cloaks lined with red silk. Sally's different. She wants someone clever and sensitive. Peter is just right for her." Jack nodded. He had never thought of it that way, but he felt intuitively that Aliena was right. "She's like her grandmother," she said. "My mother fell in love with an oddity." "Sally's like your mother, and Tommy is like my father," Aliena said. Jack smiled at her. She was more beautiful than ever. Her hair was streaked with grey, and the skin of her throat was not as marble smooth as it used to be. But as she got older and lost the roundness of motherhood, the fine bones of her lovely face became more prominent, and she took on a spare, almost structural beauty. Jack reached out and traced the line of her jaw. "Like my flying buttresses," he said. She smiled. He ran his hand down her neck and across her bosom. Her breasts had changed, too. He remembered when they had stuck out from her chest as if they were weightless, the nipples pointing up. Then, when she was pregnant, they had become even bigger, and the nipples had grown larger. Now they were lower and softer, and they swung delightfully from side to side when she walked. He had loved them through all their changes. He wondered what they would be like when she was old. Would they become shriveled and wrinkled? "I'll probably love them even then," he thought. He felt her nipple harden under his touch. He leaned forward to kiss her lips.
"Jack, you're in church," she murmured.
"Never mind," he said, and he ran his hand over her belly to her groin. There was a footstep on the stair. He pulled away guiltily. She grinned at his discomfiture. "That's God's judgment on you," she said irreverently. "I'll see to you later," he whispered in a mock, threatening tone. The footsteps reached the top of the stair, and Prior Jonathan emerged. He greeted them both solemnly. He looked grave. "There's something I want you to hear, Jack," he said. "Will you come to the cloisters?"
"Of course."
Jack got to his feet. Jonathan went back down the spiral staircase. Jack paused at the doorway and pointed a threatening finger at Aliena. "Later," he said.
"Promise?"
she said with a grin. Jack followed Jonathan down the stairs and through the church to the door in the south transept that led into the cloisters. They went along the north walk, past the schoolboys with their wax tablets, and stopped at the corner. With an inclination of his head, Jonathan directed Jack's attention to a monk, sitting alone on a stone ledge halfway down the west walk. The monk's hood was up, covering his face, but as they paused, the man turned, looked up, and then quickly averted his gaze. Jack took an involuntary step back. The monk was Walleran Bygod. Jack said angrily, "What's that devil doing here?"
"Preparing to meet his maker," Jonathan said.
Jack frowned. "I don't understand."
"He's a broken man," Jonathan said. "He's got no position, no power, and no friends. He's realized that God doesn't want him to be a great and powerful bishop. He's seen the error of his ways. He came here on foot and begged to be admitted as a humble monk, to spend the rest of his days asking God's forgiveness for his sins."
"I find that hard to believe," said Jack.
"So did I at first," said Jonathan, "but in the end I realized that he has always been a genuinely God-fearing man."
Jack looked skeptical.
"I really think he was devout. He just made one crucial mistake. He believed that the end justifies the means in the service of God. That permitted him to do anything, including conspiring to murder an archbishop."
Jonathan held up his hands in a defensive gesture. "God must punish him for that, not I."
Jack shrugged. It was the kind of thing Philip would have said.
Jack saw no reason to let Walleran live in the priory. However, that was the way of monks. Why did you want me to see him? He wants to tell you why they hanged your father. Jack suddenly felt cold. Walleran was sitting as still as a stone, gazing into space. He was barefoot. The fragile white ankles of an old man were visible below the hem of his homespun habit. Jack realized that Walleran was no longer frightening. He was feeble, defeated, and sad. Jack walked slowly forward and sat down on the bench a yard away from Walleran. "The old King Henry was too strong," Walleran said without preamble. "Some of the barons didn't like it. They were too restricted. They wanted a weaker king next time. But Henry had a son, William." "All this was ancient history. That was before I was born," Jack said. "Your father died before you were born," Walleran said, with just a hint of his old superciliousness. Jack nodded. "Go on, then." "A group of barons decided to kill Henry's son, William. Their thinking was that if the succession was in doubt, they would have more influence over the choice of the new king." Jack studied Walleran's pale, thin face, searching for evidence of guile. The old man just looked weary, beaten, and remorseful. If he was up to something, Jack could see no sign of it. "But William died in the wreck of the White Ship," Jack said. "That shipwreck was no accident," Walleran said. Jack was jolted. Could this be true? The heir to the throne murdered just because a group of barons wanted a weak monarchy? But it was no more shocking than the murder of an archbishop. "Go on," he said. "The barons' men scuttled the ship and escaped in a boat. Everybody else drowned, except for one man who clung to a spar and floated ashore." "That was my father," Jack said. He was beginning to see where this was leading. Walleran's face was white and his lips were bloodless. He spoke without emotion and did not meet Jack's eyes. "He was beached near a castle that belonged to one of the conspirators, and they caught him. The man had no interest in exposing them. Indeed, he never realized that the ship had been scuttled. But he had seen things which would have revealed the truth to others if he had been allowed to go free and talk about his experience. So they kidnapped him, brought him to England, and put him in the care of some people they could trust." Jack felt profoundly sad. All his father had ever wanted to do was entertain people, Mother said. But there was something strange about Walleran's story. "Why didn't they kill him right away?" Jack said. "They should have," Walleran said unemotionally. "But he was an innocent man, a jongleur, someone who gave everyone pleasure. They couldn't bring themselves to do it." He gave a mirthless smile. "Even the most ruthless people have some scruples, ultimately." "Then why did they change their minds?" "Because eventually he became dangerous, even here. At first he threatened no one. He couldn't even speak English. But he learned, of course, and he began to make friends. So they locked him in the prison cell below the dormitory. Then people began to ask why he was locked away. He became an embarrassment. They realized they would never rest easy while he was still alive. So in the end they told us to kill him." "So easy," thought Jack. "But why did you obey them?" "We were ambitious, all three of us," Walleran said, and for the first time his face showed emotion as his mouth twisted in a grimace of remorse. "Percy Hamley, Prior James, and me. Your mother told the truth. We all were rewarded. I became an archdeacon, and my career in the church was off to a splendid start. Percy Hamley became a substantial landowner. Prior James got a useful addition to the priory property." "And the barons?" "After the shipwreck, Henry was attacked in the following 3 years by Fulk of Anjou, William Clito in Normandy, and the King of France. For a while he looked very vulnerable. But he defeated his enemies and ruled for another 10 years. However, the anarchy the barons wanted did come in the end when Henry died without a male heir, and Stephen came to the throne. While the civil war raged for the next 2 decades, the barons ruled like kings in their own territories, with no central authority to curb them. And my father died for that." "Even that
turned sour. Most of those barons died in the fighting, and some of their sons did, too. And the little lies we had told in this part of the country to get your father killed eventually came back to haunt us. Your mother cursed us after the hanging, and she cursed us well. Prior James was destroyed by the knowledge of what he had done, as Remigius said at the nepotism trial. Percy Hamley died before the truth came out, but his son was hanged. And look at me. My act of perjury was thrown back at me almost 50 years later, and it ended my career. Walleran was looking grey-faced and exhausted, as if his rigid self-control was a terrible strain. We were all afraid of your mother because we weren't sure what she knew. In the end, it wasn't much at all. But it was enough. Jack felt as drained as Walleran appeared. At last he had learned the truth about his father. Something he had wanted all his life. Now he could not feel angry or vengeful. He had never known his real father, but he had had Tom, who had given him the love of buildings which had been the second greatest passion of his life. Jack stood up. The events were all too far in the past to make him weep. So much had happened since then, and most of it had been good. He looked down at the old sorry man sitting on the bench. Ironically, it was Walleran who was now suffering the bitterness of regret. Jack pitied him. How terrible, Jack thought, to be old and know that your life has been wasted. Walleran looked up, and their eyes met for the first time. Walleran flinched and turned away as if his face had been slapped. For a moment, Jack could read the other man's mind, and he realized that Walleran had seen the pity in his eyes. And for Walleran, the pity of his enemies was the worst humiliation of all. 4. Philip stood at the west gate of the ancient Christian city of Canterbury, wearing the full, gorgeously coloured regalia of an English bishop, and carrying a jewelled crozier worth a king's ransom. It was pouring with rain. He was 66 years of age, and the rain chilled his old bones. This was the last time he would venture so far from home, but he would not have missed this day for all the world. In a way, today's ceremony would crown his life's work. It was 3.5 years after the historic murder of Archbishop Thomas. In that short span of time, the mystical cult of Thomas Becket had swept the world. Philip had had no idea of what he was starting when he led that small candlelit procession through the streets of Canterbury. The Pope had made Thomas a saint with almost indecent speed. There was even a new order of monk knights in the Holy Land called the Knights of St. Thomas of Acre. King Henry had not been able to fight such a powerful popular movement. It was far too strong for any one individual to withstand. For Philip, the importance of the whole phenomenon lay in what it demonstrated about the power of the state. The death of Thomas had shown that, in a conflict between the church and the crown, the monarch could always prevail by the use of brute force, but the cult of St. Thomas proved that such a victory would always be a hollow one. The power of a king was not absolute, after all. It could be restrained by the will of the people. This change had taken place within Philip's lifetime. He had not merely witnessed it, he had helped to bring it about, and today's ceremony would commemorate that. A stocky man with a large head was walking toward the city, out of the mist of rain. He wore no boots or hat. At some distance behind him followed a large group of people on horseback. The man was King Henry. The crowd was as quiet as a funeral, while the rain-drenched king walked through the mud to the city gate. Philip stepped into the road, according to the prearranged plan, and walked in front of the barefoot king, leading the way to the cathedral. Henry followed with head bowed, his normally jaunty gait rigidly controlled, his posture a picture of penitence. Awestruck townspeople gazed on in silence as the King of England humbled himself before their eyes. The king's entourage followed at a distance. Philip led him slowly through the cathedral gate. The mighty doors of the splendid church were open wide. They went in, a solemn procession of two people that was the culmination of the political crisis of the century.
The nave was packed. The crowd parted to let them through. People spoke in whispers, stunned by the sight of the proudest king in Christendom, soaking wet, walking into church like a beggar. They went slowly along the nave and down the steps into the crypt. There, beside the new tomb of the martyr, the monks of Canterbury were waiting, along with the greatest and most powerful bishops and abbots of the realm. The king knelt on the floor. His courtiers came into the crypt behind him. In front of everyone, Henry of England, second of that name, confessed his sins and said that he had been the unwitting cause of the murder of St. Thomas. When he had confessed, he took off his cloak. Beneath it he wore a green tunic and a hair shirt. He knelt down again, bending his back. The Bishop of London flexed a cane. The king was to be whipped. He would get 5 strokes from each priest and 3 from each monk present. The strokes would be symbolic.